Like many of you parents, we taught our kids at a very early age to not call other people, especially brothers and sisters, by names. And one of the names that we came down hard on was if they ever called anybody stupid. That was something that we just had very little tolerance for. But as they grew, we found out that sometimes we had to chat with them to explain the distinction when somebody does something stupid. Because sooner or later in life, you see people doing stupid things. And they go, well, Daddy. And no, just because somebody does something dumb doesn't mean you're allowed to call them that, to call them stupid. Stupid comes from a Latin word, stupidus. Pretty close. You didn't know you were that close to being able to speak Latin, did you? Well, it comes from the word stupidus. And literally, it means struck senseless. Struck senseless. That's the literal translation. Think for a minute. What is the stupidest thing, the most struck senseless thing that we do? What is the stupidest thing that humans do? Well, when you think about it, isn't sin the dumbest thing in the world to do? Any sin. Even if you remove the issue of eternal life and eternal death, which you can't, and we don't, but you just take the violation of God's law, any law, it's just dumb. Sin is dumb because it hurts. It always hurts. If we were to brainstorm here and sit down and think about all the possible scenarios that involve sin and what people do, how many would we come up with? And would any of them be inconsequential? Would there be any sin that we could come up with and end up scratching our heads and say, well, I don't see how that damages anybody in any way at any time? No, every single sin has some level of damage, either sooner or later. It's there. So if it's that damaging, I guess the only conclusion we can come to is that it's dumb to sin. It really is. It's just dumb to sin. And we look at the troubles in the world. We look at the troubles in people's lives. We see past troubles in our own lives, maybe current troubles in our own lives. And we can generally see that sin is at the root of it. Now, you might say, well, I think this one was just because of bad judgment. But how much bad judgment in life stems from sin at one time or another? It's just there. And since we live in a world of sin, it's all around us, every day, all day long. Sin is inevitably something that you just can't escape saying that, well, sin is pretty stupid. And humans are just sort of dumb that way, it seems like. You know, I'm not wanting to call anybody names, but it just is that way. Probably there is not a person in here who has not at some time in our lives been on our knees before God asking his forgiveness and thinking about what we did and telling ourselves, that was so stupid. Why did I do that? Why in the world did I say that? Why did I think that? Why did I do that? And you kick yourself. It was probably running through Adam and Eve's mind as they left the garden. I gave this sermon in Sherman a few weeks ago, and the next Sabbath, one of the young mothers came up to me. She said, I have to tell you this. She said, I was taking my little girl, 4 or 5 years old, to the bathroom. Had to take her to the bathroom during your sermon. And we got out in the hall, and she said, Mommy, why is that man calling people stupid? And she said, no, dear, he's not calling people stupid. He's just saying that humans do some stupid things. She said, oh. She said, like if I eat a donut, when you tell me not to eat the donut, that would be stupid, right? She said, got it. Well, how many times have humans eaten the donuts after God told us not to do it? You know, we just do these things. So, not only do we do that, we're crazy. Albert Einstein is credited with the statement, the observation, that insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. And yet, isn't that the story of humanity? When it comes to sin, we humans have done the same things over and over and over and over. It's not like new sins evolve out of nowhere. It's always been the same list of sins. They've always been there, and we just keep on repeating them. Individuals repeat, generations repeat, humanity throughout history has repeated. The day that the Russians invaded Ukraine and you saw what was coming, it just makes you want to pull your hair and say, can't we find a better way? Here we go again, doing the same old dumb thing. I think it's like humans have just decided that, well, the only way to deal with life is to try to use sin to your advantage some way over the next guy. It's strange, isn't it? But have you ever thought about this? God's people are called to understand and take a different view of this. We have been given an opportunity to learn some things, and once we begin learning, we begin to think a lot. We begin to think a lot about these opposing concepts of sin and righteousness. We begin to consider, how much does the world think about this? How much talk do you hear in society about sin and righteousness? But your mind begins to go to that. There's a shift that takes place when you start learning God's way, and we begin to think a lot about this. And actually, God expects us. He does expect us to become, if you will, like professional students, where we become professionals at understanding both sin and righteousness. He teaches us to take sin and to walk around it and to look at it from all angles and to think about all the permutations of it. And we begin to understand this. We begin to study it. We begin to think, where does this come from? And we begin to understand that. How does it work on our motivation? How does it affect us mentally and emotionally and spiritually? And how does it present itself? Why does it present itself so deceptively? Why does it trick people so easily? Who's the driving force behind it? How does it trap us? How does it trap people in its ways? How does one sin affect another sin? You know, one action leads to another. And it plays off of each other in those ways. How is it that it blinds people? We begin to think about all of these things. I have spent my lifetime studying sin. And you have too, since you came into an understanding of God's way, because it's important. And we begin to understand it. This is a matter of life and death, and so we study it throughout life. That's what Christians do. That's what we do. And simultaneously, God wants us to become experts on righteousness. And we begin to think and learn about righteousness, studying it, learning about it, looking at all aspects of it, walking around that and looking at everything we can understand about righteousness, understanding the depths of it. And we research that and consider that just like we do sin, all aspects. Where does it come from? How does it work on our motivation? How does it affect us mentally and spiritually and emotionally? How it, unlike sin, never presents itself deceptively. It never does that. But it does present itself as something that we have to pursue. And so we begin to learn about how righteousness works, how it doesn't come naturally, how it frees people, though, from sin, how the Spirit of God works as the driving force behind it, how one aspect of righteousness can lead to other steps of righteousness, other aspects of it, why it opens our minds to understanding sin itself, why righteousness takes spiritual discernment and spiritual insight to understand and apply it. Grasping what righteousness is also a matter of life and death. And so we study it all our lives. That's what Christians do. We study righteousness and sin. And the more you gain in knowledge of the Bible, you begin to realize that so much of what is in this book is a record of sin and righteousness. Stories, examples, telling us how it works, how life works under sin, how life works under righteousness. So much in this book is dedicated to those great lessons. It is a book of case studies about the motivation and the thinking that led people to sin or led people to righteousness. It's also a book of repetition. We see over and over the lessons laid out for us to see. And we see that these lessons have been preserved so that we can make a right choice in life. Choose life that you and your seed may live. That's it. Understand, choose life so that you and your seed may live. Any other choice is what? Well, isn't any other choice than that stupid? Isn't it stupid to choose death? That was one of the dumbest choices we could make, would be to choose death. When you study this book and comprehend the impact of sin and righteousness on our lives now, to say nothing of the future, but even the impact on our lives now, the understanding heart realizes that the only smart way to live, the only smart way to live is the way of righteousness, and the only sane thing to do is to stop sinning. That's what is sane, because we know the results. The bottom line, sin is dumb and crazy. Righteousness is smart and sane. Now, the Apostle Paul understood this very well. In his own life, he made a statement once where he said that there was a time when he was so full of himself, by his own admission, in essence, that he came to see that was just so dumb. He said all of that way of thinking was just, he called it garbage later. And as he matured and took on, was given the responsibility of helping others see things, he wrote a letter one time to a congregation. It was just a little earlier than this time of the year. And he focused a lot on principles of living smart and living sane. If you want a title to this message, that's it. Living smart, living sane. The Corinthians were a fairly confident group. Probably very overconfident, in fact. And we could even go so far as to calling them self-confident. They were pretty sure that they were doing the right things. They were very secure in their understanding that we are doing the right things. A good student of sin and righteousness will instantly recognize that line of thinking and will say, don't go there, don't go down that road, because being very self-confident takes you to some not very smart places. In 1 Corinthians 10, Paul spent some time exploring and explaining something about the nature of sin. And he pulled out as a teaching lesson, he used he approached this from a number of different ways throughout the book, but he used in this chapter a history lesson about the church's ancestry. And he reviewed five things that caused Israel to be overthrown in the wilderness, and then he drew a really important lesson for the moment. Paul also made the point that these things were preserved for us. They were preserved for us. But we also know that just because a lesson is preserved does not mean that the lesson is learned, does it? Sometimes it's preserved, but that doesn't mean that it's learned. Smart people try to learn from other people's mistakes, though, don't they? They are observant. They are to learn from other people's mistakes. We're all going to make plenty of our own, but we also want to learn as we watch other people make their own mistakes. It's sort of crazy not to, isn't it? Isn't it sort of, since I'm throwing around words like dumb and stupid, isn't it sort of dumb to look at somebody's bad example and say, yep, that's what got them in trouble, and then turn around and do the same thing ourselves? That's not too smart, but it happens. The thing is, we humans tend to be better students after we have exercised the wrong choices a lot of times. It's easier to do it afterwards than before, it seems. It's easy to look back It's easy to look back and say, oh yeah, that's what I should have seen. That's what I should have done back at that point. You know you are maturing when you can catch yourself, when you learn to catch yourself before reaching the point of decision. But when you're thinking about something, when you can catch yourself at that point and think about where will this path lead and where will that path lead? That is something to grow into. If I do this, that's going to happen. If I do that, this is going to happen. And now I will make my choice based on what I have thought through. The student who has learned the lessons before they make the choice will be a much more effective and beneficial person. It's smart. It's sane. There are some deep lessons here in 1 Corinthians 10. Let's begin in verse 1. He said, "Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all of our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea, all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink. For they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ." They had lived in a remarkable time. They saw many blessings from God directly, miraculously. They had seen protection. They had been given guidance. They had been given sustenance. They had seen forgiveness, deliverance. And he had clearly intervened to demonstrate to them that he was there. He was on their side. He was right there for them, and he could control their lives for the best. And this was better than anything they could have ever have hoped for. But he did not do everything for them. He was there, but he expected them to do some things too. He opened the sea for them, but he did not give them a seagoing cruise ship to make the transport across the Red Sea. He did not build a highway for them through the desert. He had them do some things. He wasn't their genie in a bottle doing whatever they wanted. But he did want to needed to teach them, to get into their hearts. So Paul is explaining here the parallel between God's people under Moses and God's people under Christ. Through baptism, we are provided with our spiritual food and drink. Everything we need is given to us through God's Spirit for this trek in life. And like the Israelites, God's not going to do everything for us. He wants us to learn things. We need to learn things along the way. He wants to get into our hearts. Verse 5. "But with most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. Of the generation that left Egypt, only two people went into the promised land in Canaan, Joshua and Caleb. The rest were scattered in the wilderness. They died off. They didn't lose their eternal lives, but they lost their physical lives." And there are some great teaching parallels, and he begins to make that point in verse 6. "These things happened, or rather, these things became our examples." They became our examples. He mentions that twice in this chapter, also in verse 11. We'll come to that. So what happened? These things that happened. What happened? The first thing he says is, "To the intent," this is the first of five things, "that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted, and do not become idolaters as were some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Nor let us commit sexual immorality as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 fell. Nor let us tempt Christ as some of them also tempted, and were destroyed by serpents. Nor murmur, as some of them also murmured, and were destroyed by the destroyer." So five things here: covetousness or lust, idolatry, immorality, tempting God or testing God, it can be rendered, straining his patience, and murmuring, grumbling. Now, I think it's wonderful that we can read this and realize that it is so, I'm so grateful that humanity has progressed so far and grown so much in our understanding of how life works that we've learned these lessons and we don't have to deal with these sorts of things anymore like they did back then. I speak as a fool. No, we read this, you read these things and you sort of wonder, why are we dealing with the same things today? Why is humanity dealing with the same things today? When Paul wrote, he was talking about things that had happened about 1,400 years before. And he was telling the Corinthian church, these lessons still apply. We're reading this nearly 2,000 years after Paul wrote it. And we're thinking 3,400 years later and nothing has changed. It's the same things. 3,400 years later and nothing has changed. Humanity is struggling with the same things today. And it's pretty much the same things I struggle with too. Fall into these categories. What was it Einstein said? Insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. You know, it's sort of crazy, isn't it? Now, are these the only five things that will cause somebody's downfall? Of course not. But I think it's probably a pretty good bet that virtually all the things that people do in sin will probably fall under and stem from these five broad areas of life. These are common today. They've always been common. And there are a lot of lessons. You've probably heard sermons given on each of these over the years. There are a lot of lessons to each. You can go back and study the historical account, and I will leave that to you or leave it for another time. But I want to focus on what follows. There is a bigger, overarching lesson that Paul addresses that we need to consider. Beginning in verse 11, he repeats, "Now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition." They weren't written just to make the Israelites look bad. The only reason why they were written and preserved was so that there would be a record for us to learn from. They were written for our admonition, our teaching. Heard something about teaching in the sermonette. This was written so that we could learn, on whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, now the word therefore, anytime you see that, it basically means based on everything that has been said before, we conclude. So what do we conclude from all of this in the first 11 verses? Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. This is the overall lesson. Yes, each one of these sins has its own temptations and dangers and things that we have to guard against. But there's a bigger lesson that Paul is pointing out. He said the big thing in here, and actually when you look at the historical count of all of those five things that were listed, all of them point as their source to this that's mentioned in verse 12. Let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. What is the single word that you can use to describe that? What is the single word that would describe a person who thinks he stands and is not considering falling? I think that word is presumptuous. Presumptuous. Being presumptuous. The condition, it's a condition. Presumptuousness itself is not a sin, it's a condition that opens the door to sins. The Corinthians, for example, like the Israelites, they were being presumptuous. They were presuming that their thinking, that their approach was right. As he addressed in the earlier column, they were doing things that Paul said, no, that is not right. But they thought it was. They were assuming it was. They were presuming they were right in the decisions they were making, presuming they were spiritually astute, and that they were standing tall. Yes, sir, we're doing fine. And that was what he was getting at, a presumptuousness. It's a very interesting thing. Now, he's drawing the parallel to the Israelites, but it's not a totally fair parallel because the Israelites are at a disadvantage. They didn't have God's Spirit. They didn't have much background at all. And in a sense, you could say they were spiritual amateurs. They were foolish, yes, but they were also pretty shallow in their experience and in their understanding. You might say, well, they spent 40 years wandering. Shouldn't they have been smarter at the end of the 40 years? Well, you could probably argue that way, but, you know, without God's Spirit, we don't get a whole lot smarter when it comes to sin. Humans generally just don't do that. They could have learned, should have learned, but their spiritual senses were not sharp. They were not attuned. They were at that disadvantage of not having the Spirit of God. They were not mature, and they were spiritually blind. There's an example of this, though, of how that presumptuousness could affect them. In verse 9, it talks about one of those things that they fell into was tempting God, testing God. Let's go back to, keep your finger here, let's go back to Psalm 78. Psalm 78 is a really interesting chapter. It's a historical chapter of Israel and what they went through. And it's so interesting to see in Psalm 78 what it says about tempting God. In verse 17, we read, "But they sinned even more against him by rebelling against the Most High in the wilderness. And they tested God." They tested God in their heart. "By asking for the food of their fancy." Yes, they spoke against God. They said, "Can God prepare a table in the wilderness? Behold, he struck the rocks that the waters gushed out and the streams overflowed." Okay, well, can you give bread? Can you provide meat? You know, they just kept pushing, you know, no matter what he did. They were always, they were never satisfied. "Therefore the Lord heard this and was furious. So a fire was kindled against Jacob, and anger also came up against Israel, because they did not believe in God and did not trust in his salvation." Verse 41. "Yes, again and again they tempted God and limited the Holy One of Israel." The Jewish translation says they set bounds on the Holy One of Israel. "They did not remember his power, the day when he redeemed them from the enemy." And it goes on to describe that. And then in verse 56, it repeats again, "Yet they tested and provoked the Most High God and did not keep his testimonies." Now, tempting and testing is usually manifested in one of two ways. One is pushing at God by just continuing to disobey, by flagrant disobedience. God says to do this. Nope, I'm not going. You just keep pushing. And that's one of the things that is talked about here. The second one is also mentioned here, and that is putting God on trial. When we put God on trial, now, it's one thing to ask God questions. It's another thing to question God. There's a distinction. It's one thing to ask God questions. We can always ask God questions. But it's another thing to question God, to become accusative, to become doubting. What did they do? "Why did you lead us out here to die? Why did God do this? Why are you letting us down, God?" You know, that's accusative. And putting God on trial is something that humans can do. It's really good to remember, if we ever put God on trial, he gets to cross-examine. You know, there's a time when he gets to cross-examine. Job found that out, didn't he? And we don't do too well when we're cross-examined by God, I don't think. But let's go back to verse 15. Here's one of the situations where we see a lesson about presumptuousness. In verse 15, it recounts the time. It says, "He split the rocks in the wilderness and gave them drink in the abundance like the depths. He also brought streams out of the rock and caused waters to run down like rivers." This actually happened two times in Israel's history. Once was right at the beginning in Exodus 17, at the beginning of their wanderings.
And again, a second time in Exodus 20, near the end of their wanderings. Now, in the details of what happened, these two times of splitting the rock and bringing water out, in the details of that, there are some striking similarities. They needed water. They were given water. And the rock was struck, and there was a miracle. But in the first situation, Moses strikes the rock, and water comes out. 4 decades later, very similar circumstance, God tells Moses, do the same thing, except this time Moses was really ticked. He was really upset with the people. Moses had gotten near the end of his tolerance level with them. And you read in Numbers 20 and verse 10, Moses called them together at the rock, and he said, "Hear now, you rebels, must we bring water for you out of this rock?" And he strikes the rock twice with his rod. And yeah, water came out. God gave them water. But then God speaks to Moses. Now, the first time Israel was testing God, but the second time, there's a big story here about Moses tested God. Moses tempted God. God spoke to Moses and Aaron and said, "Because you did not believe me to hallow me in the eyes of the children of Israel, you shall not bring this assembly into the land that I've given them." In the first instance, Moses had acted in full obedience to God. In the second instance, he was presumptuous. He was presumptuous. He took credit to himself, did not point people to God. He acted in anger and frustration. And here's the thing. Moses was not an amateur. The children of Israel, you could say, well, they stayed amateurs. Moses was not an amateur. He was a veteran. But he fell into presumptuousness, and that made him fall into a sin, and he paid a dear price for it. Now, with God's Spirit, Moses learned. Moses grew. The Israelites, without God's Spirit, kept repeating the same mistakes over and over with succeeding generations. As you read through the history of Israel, through Joshua, Judges, Samuel, Kings, 800 years of repeating those same things. Without God's Spirit, we stay at an amateur status. We stay at a low level, a low grade of spiritual understanding as performance. But even with God's Spirit, we have to grow and we have to mature. And actually, the story of, if I can interject here, the story of Corinth is encouraging that way, because the Corinthians did grow. They learned. And with God's Spirit, they matured. And they did just that. It's a great example of presumptuousness and how it can affect a nation, how it can affect just one person or two people, a small group. And it doesn't matter where we are, presumptuousness can really take over a person. It can really lead them down a wrong path and do some bad things. So this concept of amateurs and veterans, where are we today? Where are we today? We're in an interesting time in the modern history of the church. The church has changed a lot just in my lifetime. And there are others here who've been around a lot longer than me. We've been through a lot. And by and large, we are a church made up primarily of veterans today. We're not amateurs. You look at the church, and there are a lot of people who've been around for a long time. Sometimes I look back, and I remember the day we walked into services for the first time in Houston, Texas in 1963. There were over 300 people there. We walked into that church, and that church had only been established 7 years earlier. There were, I don't know exactly how many. Mr. Salyer may know more. There were maybe a dozen baptized people when it started. However many there was, there weren't many baptized when that little church was started 7 years earlier, but it had been growing like crazy. So when we got there, so many people were like us. They were brand new. They were walking in. They'd only been there for a short time. They were coming in. And spiritually, brand new to the truth, or else pretty new. Everybody was young spiritually. Everybody was young spiritually. A new person comes into the church today, as Mr. Jones was saying, and they walk in and they are surrounded by veterans. They're surrounded by people who've been around for a long time. And that is so good. That is so helpful. Because they see people who have, you know, they've learned. They've been through a lot. They've gained wisdom. They've gained understanding. They can mentor. They can set examples. They can talk about life. Back then, you met somebody in the church who had been in the church for 7 years, and you thought, whoa, they're a grizzled old veteran. Today we look at somebody who's been in the church 7 years, and you think, well, yeah, you're coming out of being a babe in Christ. It's just a different perspective, you know, than it was back then. Back then, you'd say, wow, you've been in the church 7 years. You must know everything. Some thought they did, you know, they tried to tell others. Maybe good intent, but wasn't always wise. The church was full of amateurs in that sense. So much was new to everybody's understanding, plus everybody's experience. We were all experiencing walking this way of life, but at a very young age. Even the ministry was young, physically young and experientially young. We were all having to grow together. A few weeks ago, Mr. Franks was in Sherman. He came up and talked to my dad. He was talking to him for a while. And Mr. Merle Cunningham walks up and he starts talking. And I looked at Mr. Franks and said, do you realize there's almost 200 years of life between these two men? 193, 196. 189 years of living between two people. More important than that, though, there's well over 100 years of conversion between those two people. Between two people. Merle and my dad remembered meeting each other at a combined Houston-Dallas Spokesman Club meeting back in the 60s. They were young in the faith back then. They were young. They might have had 10 or 15 years of conversion between them. So they were young. They were amateurs. But they were growing. I was 11 when we started this way of life. This year was my 52nd Passover. I wonder if you took the average number, or if you took all the numbers of Passover who have kept the Passover. Let me rephrase that. If you took the added the number of years that everybody in this room has kept the Passover and divided it, I wonder what the average would be. I suspect it would be into several decades, on average. A few decades. During that time, I've been through a lot. You have been through a lot. We've seen a lot. We've all been battle-tested. We've learned a lot of lessons. We've seen a lot of people stand faithful. Sometimes we've wondered at those who fell in faithlessness. We've marveled at the spiritual strength of many and maybe wondered at the spiritual weakness of others, unexpectedly sometimes. We could very confidently tell somebody new, yeah, we've been there, seen that, done that. Many of you could. We all could. So we could say, well, we've got this thing down pat now, don't we? We've got this way of life. We know the ropes. We've got it down pat. Well, if we think that way, we would be walking down a line of, dare I say it, dumb thinking. It's not smart to go down that road. You know what the biggest danger is for veterans? I think one of the biggest dangers for veterans, and it's a danger for everybody, of course, but this danger does not distinguish between amateurs and veterans. It just doesn't. It's the same danger that Paul was pointing out to the Corinthians. He who thinks he stands just needs to be careful. Take heed. Think about that. Being presumptuous. Presuming. What does presumptuousness look like? What does that mean? How does it manifest itself? Well, it's defined in the dictionary several ways, and they're all related. One dictionary said it means overstepping bounds, taking liberties, sort of like Moses did. Moses just, he was mad, he was frustrated, and he acted in anger, and he overstepped his bounds. Presumptuousness is also defined as being too bold or forward, taking too much for granted, being overconfident. Thirdly, going beyond what is right or proper because of an excess of self-confidence or arrogance. Presumptuousness comes from the Latin verb presumere, pre meaning before, and sumere meaning to take before, to try to get something before we're ready, to take for granted. It means to base an opinion or knowledge that we have, to base an opinion on knowledge that we have and stick to it. This is what I know, this is what I believe, this is where I am, this is what's right. People who are presumptuous usually find out later, oh, I wasn't right. I wasn't right. That's the biggest issue in life. Closely related to it is assuming, presuming, and assuming. They have slight differences of meaning. I won't go into that, but Moses was a veteran. Moses was a veteran, but in that moment, he just assumed too much, took too much on himself, and he was suddenly, in his anger, presumptuous. He was presumptuous. It cost him. It cost him something dear, something he had longed for and wanted to see for decades. He really wanted to go to the promised land. And even when he repented, as he did, and asked God to let me enter the promised land, God said, no, not this time. You might think, well, why was God harsh? Moses was sorry. Why didn't God just let him go in? Because God wanted something to really go deeply into his heart. God was more concerned about Moses entering eternal life than he was going into the promised land. That was more important. And so he left Moses that way, and it was designed, God's decision was designed to strengthen Moses' life, to strengthen his understanding. But it was through a lesson. Let him who thinks he stands take heed. Stop. Think. Be smart. Don't be crazy. Take heed. Peter had a take on this too. In 2 Peter 2 and verse 10, 2 Peter 2:10, when you read these men writing these things, of course they're under the inspiration of God's Spirit, but they are also drawing on their own experiences, things they had learned, things they recognized. In 2 Peter 2 and verse 10, well, let's read verse 9, and it's breaking into a thought, but we'll just pick it up in verse 9. Then the Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptations. We're going to come back and see that in a moment. And to reserve the unjust under punishment for the day of judgment, and especially those who walk according to the flesh in the lust of uncleanness and despise authority. You know, you may be recalling several of those five things we read in 1 Corinthians 10 that tripped up Israel. They trip up a lot of people. Lust of uncleanness, despise authority. He said, they are presumptuous, self-willed based on having a high opinion of self, not humble, and that leads to, it ties in with being presumptuous. They are not afraid to speak evil of dignitaries. You know, it all spills over. One thing leads to another in terms of behavior. These are interesting words from Peter, because we're pretty sure Peter understood presumptuousness. Peter understood presumptuousness. he too had learned some lessons, some hard lessons about that very thing. And as a result, Peter could spot it, and Peter could warn about it. I suspect, don't you, that Peter probably thought about this daily, if not daily, very regularly, because of what he had gone through. And if he didn't think about it, he had reminders. You know, the day I was preparing this sermon, I thought about Peter. I was sitting on my porch early in the morning. Now, as Mr. Burnett mentioned, we moved up to Sherman, but we don't live in Sherman. We moved out in the country. I'm back to my country roots, and I'm very grateful for it. But we have roosters to the back, roosters to the side, and roosters to that side. We are surrounded by roosters. Let me tell you something about roosters if you don't know about this. Roosters do not crow to announce the breaking of a new day. Roosters crow at any time of the day. Roosters crow at 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning. It doesn't matter. And then when one starts, then they get into a contest. And you hear the one in the back, and then here comes this one, and here comes that one, and they get into these crowing contests. And you just say, come on, guys, it's 2 in the morning. Look at your clock. The sun's not anywhere near up. But they just go all the time. I'm not complaining. I like it. After a week, you don't hear them anymore. I like getting up in the morning. I'd rather listen to roosters and guineas than sirens in the city. You know, I enjoy it. But consider this. What did Peter think about every time he heard a rooster? Every time Peter heard a rooster, do you think that might have triggered something for him? He might have thought about being presumptuous and what that does, because that had been Peter's nature. We all are presumptuous from time to time, but that was just part of Peter's nature. It was his default position that he seemed to go back to. There were many times, many accounts of this. Jesus would say one thing, Peter would come back with a different opinion without stopping to think it through first. We just presume. There are many stories, but just on the night of that last Passover, you have the accounts, Peter, you'll never wash my feet. That was sort of presumptuous. If all these guys forsake you, I never will. They're not going to take you without a fight from me. Amateur mistakes. Amateur mistakes. Dumb mistakes. Insane. Wouldn't you say it's insane to argue against the Christ? That's not a smart thing to do, but it came so naturally because it was self-reliance. It was self-reliance instead of God-reliance. It was self-will. When Peter wrote this, I think he wrote it because he understood it. He had learned it, and now he was teaching what it meant. You know, in Luke 22, did Peter remember this? Luke 22, it says, the Lord said, Simon, Simon, indeed Satan has asked for you that he may sift you as wheat. But I have prayed for you that your faith should not fail, and when you have returned to me, strengthen the brethren. But he said to him, Lord, I'm ready to go with you both to prison and to death. And then Jesus said, Peter, I tell you, the rooster shall not crow this day before you will deny 3 times that you know me. Matthew adds more to that account. In Matthew's account, said, Peter answered and said, even if all are made to stumble because of you, I will never be made to stumble. It's like, I can see these other guys. Yeah, I know him and I know him. I can see him stumbling, but I never will. Jesus said to him, assuredly, I say this night before the rooster crows, you will deny me 3 times. And Peter comes right back. And Peter said to him, even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you. And so said all the disciples. Presumptuousness in one person can, like it can attract a crowd. It can attract a crowd. It can gather a head of steam because it's appealing. Nobody wants to think of themselves as being able to deny Christ. And thinking we are strong enough to stand is, you know, that's easy for us to go to. That it helps our ego. Nobody wants to look at themselves and say, yeah, I can see, I could really, oh boy, I could go down that road. No, all the disciples said that. Peter, here's what happened with presumptuousness in Peter's life. He missed the warning from Christ. It made him miss the warning, but he didn't miss the deceit from within. Presumptuousness got the best of him. Think about it this way. If you're living smart spiritually, when you hear Christ say, you will all forsake me, what would be the smart thing to reply with? What would be smart? Well, it would be smart to say, stop, Jesus, wait a minute. Can we back up to what you just said? What are you telling me? What are you telling me about myself? You must know something about me that I don't know or don't think, because you're God and I'm not. So you must know something. Help me to understand. That would be the smart thing, wouldn't it? But presumptuousness makes us blurt without thinking. And that's what Peter did. And he says, you know, hey, even though all will deny you, all can leave you, but I won't. I stand. That's what Paul was writing about. The fall came quickly and dramatically. Later that night, Peter was accused by several of being one of Jesus' disciples, and he said in Luke 22, man, I don't know what you're saying. Matthew's account says he began to curse and swear. He went places he didn't think he would go. And it says, immediately while he was still speaking, the rooster crowed. And the Lord turned and looked at Peter. And Peter remembered the words of the Lord and how he had said to him, before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times. So Peter went out and wept bitterly. It was a hard lesson, but it was a good lesson, because Peter became a different person after that. And then once the day of Pentecost came and Peter and the others received God's Spirit, they were really on the road to being different people. But I can't help but think that for the rest of his life, whenever Peter heard a rooster crow, he probably had a different reaction than you or I might. I wonder if sitting on the porch in the dark of the morning drinking his coffee and you hear the rooster crow, and we can sit there and say, oh, there's Mr. Rooster. I wonder if Peter's mind went to a different place. I wonder if Peter was reminded what it means to be presumptuous, to be self-assured. These things can become our greatest enemies, and yet they can be so blindly comforting, and we can snuggle up to them. When the rooster crowed, did Peter ever remind himself, be careful about being presumptuous? Did he ever remind himself, yes, listen to God, talk to God, seek to really hear what God has to say, check in with Him, ask God, help me to be smart, help me not to think in the crazy ways I used to think, where I would trust my own instincts and rely on my own intuition. You know, brethren, I think one of the smartest prayers we can pray, one of the most needful prayers to pray every day is, God, Father, help me think. Just help me think the right way. Help me think. Help me think your way. Think your thoughts. See things through your eyes. Not to be too hasty to jump to my own conclusions and rely on myself, but to let this mind be in me that was in Christ Jesus. Help me to think. It's a good prayer. I strongly suspect any rooster crowing rang those bells for Peter all the rest of his days. I suspect there are things that ring our bells too. Not roosters, but we probably all remember things that, okay, yep, that was a great lesson learned. Paul knew that too. But you know, there's another side to it. I think maybe Peter also was reminded about the fact that God is there and God will guide and God will take care of you. This is something that Paul wrote about. Paul had also learned to live smart and sane. Going back to 1 Corinthians 10, Paul ends this on a very encouraging note, a tremendously encouraging note. And those who are veterans of God's way of life can attest to this. You can understand this and attest to it and believe it with all your heart. In verse 13, he says, No temptation has overtaken you, such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will also make the way of escape that you may be able to bear it. There will be temptations, there will be tests. The world is full of it. We live in the middle of it. And this verse is really important in a couple of ways. It's important to know that no temptation has come over us that everybody else doesn't have to deal with. These things are common. There's no need to think that we're alone. There's nothing but such as is common to man. Let me illustrate this quickly and why it's important. I thought of this verse a few weeks ago on a Sunday afternoon driving home, and I turned on NPR and was listening to a podcast called The Hidden Brain. Very interesting program that they have. And this particular show was on how to be a resilient human being. How to be resilient. They were doing an interview with a lady named Dr. Lucy Hone, who lives in New Zealand. And she was telling the story about how she was researching resilience, and particularly in terms of working with the military, because soldiers are often in situations in life where they really need to be resilient with all the stresses they face. And then in 2011, while she was in the middle of her studies, the Christchurch earthquake hit in New Zealand, killed 185 people, and she found herself counseling a lot of people about how to be resilient during that tragedy. And then in 2014, 3 years later, her best friend's daughter, and her 12-year-old daughter, Abby, were all killed instantly by somebody running a red light. And now she went from being a counselor to needing counseling. And she knows whereof she speaks when it comes to dealing with tests and trials and temptations. After hearing this podcast, I went to watch one of her TED Talks. She referred to that during the podcast. You can find it by searching TED Talks and looking up Lucy Hone, H-O-N-E. At the beginning of her TED Talk, she did something that was so effective, and I would like to do the same here. Now, this may be a little sensitive, and I don't want to open, you know, any wounds, but I ask you to do this in order to make a very important point about 1 Corinthians 10. I'm going to list some conditions in life, and I would like to ask you to stand if any of these conditions apply to you. If you have ever had to suffer yourself or have lost a loved one due to a long-term illness, such as cancer or heart attack, would you stand? If you have ever lost a loved one due to an accident or war or some kind of sudden tragedy, would you stand? If you have ever had to cope, either with yourself or with a loved one, with mental illness or suicide or Alzheimer's or dementia, would you stand? If you have ever had a miscarriage or abortion or struggled with infertility or lost a child, would you stand? If you have ever lost a relationship with someone you truly loved, ever had your heart broken, ever been through a divorce, suffered loss of a friendship, would you stand? If you have ever lived through a natural disaster, been bullied, been fired from a job, declared bankruptcy, would you stand? Now, look around you. I will quote Dr. Hone, "Adversity doesn't discriminate." Adversity doesn't discriminate. If you are alive, you're going to have to, or you have already had to, deal with tough times. Thank you. You can sit. Here's something to think about as it relates to what Paul was saying here. No temptation has overtaken you such as is common to man. We're all in this together. We're all in this together. Dr. Hone went on to make the point, it's fruitless, it's a waste of time and energy to ask, why me? She said, it's pointless. And here's somebody who had suffered the worst of tragedies. She said, bad things happen to everyone. Now here's somebody looking at life's events and realize that, you know, you can go down some paths of thinking that aren't smart. Here we are, though, we're going even deeper than that. We are looking at not just life's events, but we're also looking at sin. And we realize we can go down lines of thinking that aren't smart. It's not healthy. It's not good for us. And it's good for us, though, to know that we're not alone. We're all in this together. And not only that, but you're surrounded by others who have been down the road. They've walked through those valleys. They've seen those things. They've learned. They've learned we can help one another. We do help one another. We can support one another. It's like Mr. Jones was saying in the sermonette, this is one way we teach one another. When you talk to somebody and say, yeah, I've been in your shoes, you're veterans. That's how veterans can make a stronger, stronger church. Not like the Israelites who went down the road, why me? Why are you doing this to us, Moses? Why isn't God acting better? We're going to do it our way now. And then the next thing to remember, God is faithful. Smart Christians, sane Christians, study this, know this, and rely on this. They're not listening to the world, listening to God, trusting Him. When those times of doubt flit into our minds, we go back to where we ought to be and realize God has been down that path too. If God and Jesus Christ had been sitting here in this audience today, they would have stood with you. God lost His Son. God watched a lot of things happen. Christ was tempted in every point, as we are, but without sin. He lived smart. He lived sane. God knows how much we can endure. We don't. He knows the route He's taking us, and if we are smart and sane, we will trust Him. Trust Him deeply. Let's end with Psalm 19. Psalm 19, it's one of my favorite hymns for both the melody and the words. We only have three verses in our hymn, and I wish he would have covered more than just verses 1 through 8. The rest of the chapter is deserving at least another three verses. Psalm 19. And verse 7. Well, I'm sorry, let's skip ahead. Verse 12. Who can understand His errors? Well, God's people can. With God's Spirit, we understand our errors and we learn. We learn not to be presumptuous. It's a continual learning process. Smart, sane Christians can understand those errors based on sin. It's not smart. It's dumb. And repeating them is just constantly increasing the insanity. Cleanse me from secret faults. Keep back your servant also from presumptuous sins. Let them not have dominion over me. Then I shall be blameless and I shall be innocent of great transgression. Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, my strength and my redeemer. Verses 12, 13, and 14. Let this be our quest. Let this be our goal. This our pursuit. That's smart. That's sane.